Welcome to the podcast. It's Kevin Harris with Dr. William Lane Craig and Reasonable Faith. Bill, it's so funny that so many things that we talk about here on this podcast are also in the news. I wonder if we're having some impact on the media. We're looking at this Atlantic article, What Happened Before the Big Bang, the New Philosophy of Cosmology. Ross Anderson wrote this piece, and he did it by interviewing Tim Maudlin, who was recently hired by New York University, the top-ranked philosophy department in the English-speaking world. Maudlin is a philosopher of physics whose interests range from the foundations of physics to topics more firmly within the domain of philosophy, like metaphysics and logic. Tim Maudlin, you're familiar with him?
Yes, brilliant, brilliant philosopher of science. His work has been very helpful to me in my own study of special and general relativity theory and trying to integrate that with an understanding of divine eternity. Maudlin was at Rutgers University for many years and is the author of really outstanding work in philosophy of time.
To be hired by New York University and their philosophy department is a real achievement. Now, he really gets some attention here by saying Stephen Hawking is brilliant, but he's wrong about philosophy. Again, this is because, as you and I have discussed, Stephen Hawking has basically said that philosophy is dead. What's Tim Maudlin's answer to that?
Well, Maudlin is not very impressed with Hawking's declaration of the death of philosophy. He says, Hawking is a brilliant man, but he's not an expert on what's going on in philosophy, evidently. Over the last 30 years, the philosophy of physics has become seamlessly integrated with the foundations of physics work done by actual physicists. So the situation is exactly the opposite of what Hawking describes. He says, I think he just doesn't know what he's talking about. He says, so I think he's just uninformed. He says, Hawking is a brilliant man, but he's not an expert in what's going on in philosophy. So what Maudlin is saying there is that over the last 30 years, there is a discipline called the philosophy of physics, and it tends to coincide with a discipline called foundations of physics, which is pursued by the physicists themselves. And these two fields have become seamlessly integrated so that those who are working on the deep questions in the foundations of physics, the underpinnings of this field, are both philosophers and physicists who are collaboratively pursuing these important philosophical questions that lie at the very root of physics. And in particular, this article focuses on the field of physics called cosmology, which is the study of the large-scale structure of the universe. And Maudlin identifies a philosophy of cosmology.
How about that?
As an area of specialization.
Lawrence Krauss is not going to like that very much. I mean, as we've noted in an earlier podcast, he thinks that that's ridiculous and a waste of time.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what Maudlin shows, I think, through these examples is that those who deprecate philosophical work in these fields simply don't know what they're talking about.
He was asked in this interview, what were the outstanding conceptual problems at the foundations of cosmology? And the central goal of the philosophy of cosmology is to identify those. Maudlin says, well, I think I would have to divide them into two classes. There are foundational problems and interpretational problems in physics, generally, say in quantum theory or in space-time theory or in trying to come up with a quantum theory of gravity that people will worry about even if they're not doing what you would call the philosophy of cosmology.
Right. So you have these general philosophical questions that he says can be of two types. One would be the foundational problems. What is time? For example, what is space? And then in addition to that, there are interpretational questions. When a theory like quantum mechanics gives descriptions by equations and makes predictions, what is the correct physical interpretation of those equations? The mathematics works, but how do you understand it physically? And in the case of quantum mechanics, that's subatomic physics, there are around 10 different competing physical interpretations of quantum theory, and nobody knows which one is correct. So there are both these foundational questions, and then there are these interpretational questions that are explored in philosophy of physics, as well as in more specific questions to the philosophy of cosmology.
Yes, jumping ahead in the article, he says exactly that. He says, quoting now, "The problem is that quantum mechanics was developed as a mathematical tool. Physicists understood how to use it as a tool for making predictions, but without an agreement or understanding about what it was telling us about the physical world. And that's very clear when you look at any of the foundational discussions." Well, in particular to quantum mechanics, the reason that that's important is because people are always saying, well, quantum mechanics answers that.
Quantum theory or quantum mechanics becomes a sort of black box.
It does.
That uninformed people can appeal to explain away almost anything. And I love what Maudlin says here in this interview. He says, "Quantum mechanics was merely a calculational technique that was not well understood as a physical theory. Bohr and Heisenberg tried to argue that asking for a clear physical theory was something you shouldn't do anymore." That's so typical, you see, of the positivist era in which they were raised. For the positivists, all that mattered were the empirical predictions and the results. And physical interpretations that were empirically equivalent, they regarded as the same theory, even though they postulated vastly different physical interpretations of what was going on. And so Maudlin says they were wrong. Bohr and Heisenberg were wrong about that. But the effect of it was to shut down perfectly legitimate physics questions within the physics community for about a half a century. And now we're coming out of that, fortunately. So this pall that positivism cast over physics suppressed certain questions about the correct physical interpretation of the theories or the equations that we're using. And now in a post-positivist era, we're fortunately coming out of that and beginning to explore these metaphysical questions again about what exactly do these theories really postulate in terms of the structures of space and time and the subatomic world that they're about.
Bill, what is this that I'm seeing, that I observe, that mathematical tools like this take on a life of their own? It becomes something that they're not when it comes to quantum mechanics, or the idea that a particle will take all possible routes and all that. And some have said, now see there, that's counterintuitive and that's impossible. How can it take all the possible routes at the same time? But that's just like real numbers and things like that. These are mathematical tools.
Exactly.
And they get out of their boundaries somehow. And
that's right. They take mathematical calculational devices, or as they're sometimes called, tricks, not in a pejorative sense, but in the sense that this is a way of solving the equation, solving the problem, getting rid of messy infinities, for example. They take those and interpret them as though they were literal physical descriptions of reality. In many cases, the interpretation is absurd. It's nonsensical to talk about the particle taking all possible paths from A to B. And yet this is then appealed to by people to answer deep metaphysical questions about creation and God and the origin of the universe, as though these physical interpretations are just to be read off the sleeves, so to speak, of these theories, which is simply not true.
Everybody hold your breath, because Maudlin here says this is the number one question that we want to answer in this field. This question of accounting for what we call the Big Bang state is probably the most important question within the philosophy of cosmology, end unquote. So he says, this question of accounting for what we call the Big Bang state, the search for a physical explanation of it, is probably the most important question within the philosophy of cosmology. And there are a couple of different lines of thought about it. One that's become more and more prevalent in the physics community is the idea that the Big Bang state itself arose out of some previous condition, and that therefore there might be an explanation of it in terms of the previously existing dynamics by which it came about. There are other ideas, for instance, that there may be a special sorts of laws or special sorts of explanatory principles that would apply uniquely to the initial state of the universe.
Right. Those two alternatives would be, on the one hand, multiverse theories, where our universe is simply a bubble in a sea of false vacuum that is expanding, and there are other bubbles, other universes like ours. That would explain the initial Big Bang state on the basis of broader conditions. Or someone like Roger Penrose prefers the second alternative, that there's special sorts of laws that would require that an initial singularity out of which our universe was spawned would be characterized by very low entropy, as the Big Bang state is. And that's the mystery, is why this highly ordered, improbable, low entropy state should mark the beginning of the universe. And of course, another special sort of explanatory principle would be to say that God created the universe with a highly ordered, low entropy state. And this has the advantage of being in accord with the scientific evidence that the universe has not always existed, that the universe, in fact, did have an absolute beginning.
He talks about bubble universes and then goes on again, and this is second time recently that this has come up. It came up with Krauss in our podcast, the anthropic principle. He's not saying that he necessarily holds to this, but he said there's a line of thought that says, well, now, if that's the case, we as living beings will certainly find ourselves in one of those bubbles that happens to support living beings.
Right. The idea is that if you have many of these bubbles of true vacuum in this sea of expanding false vacuum, and if these are randomly ordered in their constants and quantities, their initial conditions, then by chance alone, in some of these bubbles, intelligent life like ourselves would emerge, and that therefore we shouldn't really be surprised at the incredible fine-tuning of the universe for our existence in a multiverse of randomly ordered universes. Somewhere in the multiverse, such finely tuned universes will appear by chance alone. That's the hypothesis.
He also says that this is a branch of the philosophy of physics in which you happen to be treating the entire universe, which is one huge physical object, as a subject of study, rather than, say, studying just electrons by themselves or studying only the solar system. There are particular physical problems, problems of explanation, which arise in thinking about the entire universe, which don't arise when you consider only its smaller systems. And he says he would like to go on and try to articulate what those particular problems are and the avenues for solving them and so on. Well, I observe that too, Bill. Studying the universe as a whole is different from studying the parts of it. And people will point out that what applies to the parts doesn't necessarily apply to the whole.
Sure.
It seems to me they're trying to get past the contingency problem or the contingency argument by saying,
yes,
the composition fallacy, by saying, well, look, we're talking about the whole universe. We're not just talking about one piece of matter within the universe.
Right. And that's correct. You couldn't reason that the entire universe is contingent just because the various things in the universe are contingent. It could be that matter and energy themselves are necessarily existent, and then the configurations that matter and energy assume in this world are contingent. But I don't think anybody believes that, Kevin. I don't know of anyone who thinks that the matter and energy in the universe is metaphysically necessary. Think of it. According to the standard model of particle physics, on the subatomic level, matter is made up of fundamental particles, things like quarks and electrons. And these aren't composed of anything smaller than that on the standard model. These are the basic units of matter. So to say that matter exists necessarily would be to say that every quark in the universe is a metaphysically necessary being, which just seems fantastic. Does every quark in the universe exist with metaphysical necessity? Couldn't the universe have had, say, three less quarks than it does? Surely that's true. In fact, couldn't the universe have been composed of an entirely different set of quarks than the quarks of which it's made? It seems obvious that these quarks are not necessary in their being. Indeed, if there were a different model, different laws of nature, you might not have quarks at all. You might have some other fundamental entities like strings that would be the fundamental units of energy or of matter. So given that the quarks and the fundamental particles don't exist necessarily, it would follow, I think, that neither does the universe exist necessarily. Think of it in this way. Imagine, say, this table at which we're seated. Could this table, this very table, could it have been made of ice? Well, I think not. You could certainly have an ice table in place of this table, but it wouldn't be this table. Now, if that's true, a universe composed of a different collection of quarks wouldn't be the same universe. It would be a different universe. So it would show that if the quarks are contingent, the universe is also contingent. Mm. So I don't think...
If all the tiles on the roof are brown, the roof is brown.
Well, in that case, yeah. Yes. So in that case, you would not have this problem that you have just expressed, where people would try to say, well, things in the universe are contingent, but the universe itself exists necessarily. That would require us to say, I think, that every single quark in the universe is a metaphysically necessary being, which seems absurd.
Bill, off the top of your head, what do you think of some of the problems there are that would need to be looked at and solved as far as treating the universe as a whole as opposed to treating it in its parts?
Well, one would be the question of the existence of time and what is the nature of time, and is there a sort of worldwide time that measures the duration of the universe? Is temporal becoming real or illusory? These are questions that arise in this discipline and are things about which he has some good things to say.
Yeah. Don't you agree that the contingency of the universe as a whole is a major field of study?
Yes, I think philosophically that would be a deep metaphysical question. Why does the universe exist at all? Why is there any contingent reality at all?
Here's Maudlin's comment on how things in cosmology apply both to the physical realm and also the philosophical realm. He says, you know, gravity was a physical discovery of momentous importance, as important as anything you could ever imagine, because it knit together the terrestrial realm and the celestial realm into one common physical picture. But it was also a philosophical discovery in the sense that philosophy is interested in the fundamental natures of things. What a beautiful example of how philosophy and the physical sciences work together and are as legitimate as one another.
Yes, this is a good example of this issue of foundational questions that arise in physics that are profound philosophical questions as well as scientific questions. He says later in the interview, the basic philosophical question, going back to Plato, is what is X? And you fill in the blank there for the X. What is virtue? What is justice? What is matter? What is time? He says you can ask that about the dark energy in the universe that propels the acceleration of the universe. What is it? And he says it's a perfectly good question. So these are some of these deep foundational questions about the nature of the universe.
Krauss says just the opposite in that interview we listened to. He says it's not why, it's how. The why question doesn't matter. The how question is what matters.
Yeah, and you can't even answer really the how question unless you know what you're talking about. And that's this fundamental question, what is X, that Plato posed.
Finally, he does say a lot of attention has been given to the fine-tuning argument. The interviewer says, one example of philosophy of cosmology that seems to have trickled out to the layman is the idea of fine-tuning, the notion that in the set of all possible physics, the subset that permits the evolution of life is very small, and that from this, it is possible to conclude that the universe is either one of a large number of universes, a multiverse, or that perhaps some agent has fine-tuned the universe with the expectation that it generate life. Do you expect that idea to have staying power? And if not, what are some of the compelling arguments against it? Well, Maudlin agrees with the statement of it. He says, that's a perfectly correct statement of the fine-tuning argument. But it depends upon making judgments about the likelihood or probability of something. Like, how likely is it that the mass of the electron would be related to the mass of the proton in a certain way? Now, one can first be a little puzzled by what you mean by how likely or probable something like that is. You can ask how likely it is that I'll roll double sixes when I throw dice. but we understand the way you get a handle on the use of those probabilities in that instance. It's not as clear how you even make judgments like that about the likelihood of the various constants of nature and so on that are usually referred to in the fine-tuning argument.
Robin Collins, in his forthcoming book, A Well-Tempered Universe, has a long discussion of the application of probability theory to the fine-tuning argument and argues that it's using a standard probability measure that is normal in physics and that we are making judgments of epistemic probability. We're saying how likely is it, given that there is a single universe and no divine designer, that the constants and quantities would have the values that they do. And he argues that it's extremely incomprehensibly low. One way to visualize this is to imagine, and this illustration comes from John Barrow, a piece of paper with a red dot in the middle of it representing our universe. Now he says, alter the constants and quantities slightly, and that describes a new universe. If it's a life-permitting universe, make it a red dot. If it's a life-prohibiting universe, make it a blue dot. Now do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again, until the sheet of paper is filled with dots. And he says, what you will have at the end is a sea of blue with only a few pinpoints of red. And that's what it means to say that our fine-tuned universe is enormously, unfathomably improbable. The range of possibilities for the values of the constants and quantities is so vast, and the vast, vast majority of them are life prohibiting, that it becomes highly, highly improbable that a randomly thrown dart would strike a life-permitting universe.
He says here that the physicists that he talks to about fine-tuning seem to say that, look, if you have enough worlds, eventually you are going to come up with the particular fine-tuning elements that we see. So in other words, if there is a multiverse or bubble universes, this is no problem. Eventually, something is going to come up, right?
Well, it depends on whether or not the constants and quantities vary across these universes. There's two problems. First, you've got to generate the many worlds. You've got to have some mechanism that produces them. Secondly, you have to have some sort of mechanism for explaining why they would be randomly ordered in their constants and quantities. If they're not randomly ordered, then there's no guarantee at all that a life-permitting universe will appear anywhere in the ensemble of universes. And so physicists are trying to marry string theory with inflationary theory to develop a mechanism for doing this, but so far it remains wildly speculative. And moreover, it's not clear that even that theory will be free of fine-tuning. If that theory exhibits fine-tuning, then you haven't solved the problem. You've just kicked the can down the road, and you have to face it all over again on this higher level.
He says if we give up on this whole multiverse idea, and it turns out that there aren't many worlds, that physics is unable to generate them, then it's not the only option that there was some intelligent designer. He said it would be a terrible mistake to think that those are the only two ways things could go. You would have to, again, think hard about what you mean by probability and about what sorts of explanations there might be. Part of the problem is that right now there are just way too many freely adjustable parameters in physics. Everybody agrees about that. There seem to be many things we call constants of nature that you could imagine setting at different values. And most physicists think there shouldn't be that many, that many of them are related to one another, and so on.
Right. What he's saying here is that if you can get rid of the fine-tuning by showing that many of these constants and quantities are interrelated to one another, then you really don't have as many examples of fine-tuning as you thought. If you turn one dial, maybe it will affect the other dials as well. But the problem is there's just no physical evidence for this, Kevin. All the evidence we have suggests that the fine-tuning is here to stay. And every effort that we've had to suppress the fine-tuning at one point is like a ugly bump in the carpet. It pops up somewhere else. And so I think given both the multiplicity and the variety of the examples of fine-tuning, it's highly unlikely that this is going to go away with any sort of future physics. So we probably are left with the choice between an intelligent designer or agent and this multiverse hypothesis. And in my published work, I've tried to explain why this multiverse hypothesis, in the end, really is a failure at explaining the fine-tuning. Roger Penrose of Oxford University has been a determined critic of these world ensemble or many worlds hypotheses to explain away fine-tuning. What they tried to do is explain our existence on the basis of a selection effect. Namely, it's only fine-tuned universes that can have observers in them, right, like us. So why should we be surprised at observing the fine-tuning of our universe? What this fails to reckon with is that it is not true that all observable universes have to be fine-tuned. The most probable universe that is observable would be one in which a single brain fluctuates into existence out of the quantum vacuum with the illusion of seeing an external world around us. This is called a Boltzmann brain, after Ludwig Boltzmann, the great 19th century German physicist. So, the vast majority of observable worlds in the multiverse would be Boltzmann brain worlds. They would be worlds in which there's only a single brain that exists, not a finely tuned universe. So what that means is you can't explain away fine-tuning as the result of an observer selection effect, because the most probable observable universes will be universes having Boltzmann brains in them. So the fact that we observe a universe with intelligent, interactive, embodied agents is unfathomably improbable and still cries out for explanation. So it turns out this world ensemble multiverse hypothesis doesn't do anything to explain away the fine-tuning of the universe after all.
We're out of time on this podcast, but there are two more questions that Maudlin brings up in this article that we'll look at in the next podcast, dealing with time and also the evolution, the probabilities, and the problems of the evolution of intelligent life. We'll talk to you next time on Reasonable Faith.